Today is April 15th, 2021. This is a special low-tech edition of Shitpost. I'm on the road in North Carolina this month, so I don't have my normal audio rig. So if there's any discrepancy in audio quality, that's what that is. But enough about that. Let's just get straight in. I've got Colin Hoback with me. He is the director of the new HBO 6-part docuseries, Cue Into the Storm. If you watch it, you might hear a familiar voice or see a familiar face. Colin, what's up?
Hey, it's funny to be. I love that your show is called Shitpost. Considering I often describe Jim and Ron Watkins, you know, the guys who run and operate 8chan or now 8kun, as real life walking shitposts. So this is appropriate.
So, you know, Now, I remember doing the interview with you for this documentary. I think it was like 2 or 2.5 years ago now. And I remember when I saw it was coming out, especially when I saw it was coming out with HBO, all I could do was like sit and pray that like I didn't say anything stupid 2 years ago that was going to make me look really dumb. But thankfully, I made it out the other side of your documentary in one piece, I think. I think so too. But you know, having worked on it so long, I guess my first question is just a vague one, which is like, you know, I met you when you were getting started working on this just monster of a project, and now that it's all out, all 6 parts are available for streaming on HBO. How does it feel? I mean, is it kind of a relief now?
I mean, that was the main word that I could think of at the end of this sort of Herculean effort. After HBO came on, which that happened in September, it was just such a whirlwind. We knew we needed to get this out, but we needed to get it out responsibly, and that meant we had just a massive group that we had. I had to staff things up really quickly, find the most talented people that I could, and it was no joke. I mean, 15 to 17 hour days just back to back for I think about 5 months to get this done.
Wow.
So it was a bit like being hit with lightning or something at the beginning, and then at the end it was like hearing thunder, and it still feels like it's ringing in my ears a little bit, but I'm just I feel there were so many security challenges, and there was so much kind of secrecy involved with getting to the point where this made the air without any hiccups. Because obviously there were a lot of people who were interested in what I was doing. So it was enormous relief for it to finally air and for people to see the conclusions that were drawn and to. Yeah, to get this six hour film out into the world.
So Cue Into the Storm, this film, like in the first episode, one of the like earliest things that you say is just that following Cue for years like completely warped your brain. And this is something that I feel happening to myself periodically, which is just where I'll see like something out in the wild. It'll just be like a number on a street sign. Or I'll hear somebody crack a joke and it reminds me of like a weird in-group meme of some, you know, whatever conspiracy yes. or extremist movement I'm following at work. And
one of the brain worms just starts gnawing away at some neurons. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like the film turned out, I thought, great and everybody should watch it. But like, you know, even myself, like, who spends a lot of time looking at QAnon stuff, I at least get the opportunity to like look at QAnon. And then like, if I'm feeling really burnt on QAnon or if it's getting kind of slow or weird, I can move on to a different part of right-wing extremism because there's no end to this stuff. Apparently how did having Q on the brain for like 2 or 3 years affect you? Like now that it's all out, and, you know, people are reacting to it, whatever. But, like, do you think that the Q brain poison will ever leave your brain entirely? Or do you think this has changed you somehow?
Well, I mean, I think anytime you get to know people who maybe think differently than you, it's going to change your outlook a little bit. You know, I think that the stuff that was sort of the most mentally straining isn't what you would expect. I mean, honestly,
what do you mean?
It was more the economic toll of getting this thing done independently. It was some of the stress of not knowing if I was dealing with people who were directly involved with Q at any point in time, what they might be saying behind the scenes. You know, in hindsight, it seems sort of more obvious what some of the threat models should have been, but at the time it was unclear. There's some stuff that's not represented in the series where I was like undercover in a cult, I guess, for a week. It was like a fledgling cult. It wasn't a very good cult. It was like an aspiring cult. It was David Wilcock, this guy who was made famous because of Ancient Aliens. You know, that being there by myself in that environment was pretty draining. But I think, you know, with a lot of the folks who were into Q, sometimes they would call me in the middle of the night, you know, and just to have someone to talk to, just sort of as an anchor. And I didn't find that particularly draining either. But I think what you're getting at, you know, in fact, I found it rewarding because to some extent, you know, there were a number of people who were big Q believers who saw me as almost like a
fellow traveler, maybe.
Well, no, like a stabilizing force, you know, like they were so used to hearing one thing and then they would talk to me and it would be a very different perspective. And they weren't getting that anywhere else. Yeah, I mean, all of the terminology, obviously I had to read basically every Q drop. I probably read the first 500, five, six, sometimes more times than that in order to look for clues and try to pick apart which details really mattered in there. But I guess I had just put all of my mental horsepower into trying to crack the mystery. And so for me, it was all kind of clues and trying to dissect this sort of bigger picture of the mechanics of what was happening behind the scenes, forensics around it. And while some of the terminology sort of leaks into the mind, certainly, and you start to, you know, you know, you see the number 17 and you can't help but think Q. You might hear certain keywords and phrases that remind you of keywords and phrases that are part of Q, but it doesn't necessarily make you start believing those things. But I think when I reached out to Adam McKay's team, and Adam McKay, you know, made the Big Short and a number of other wonderful films. Big Short's one of my favorite films of all time. And I said to his associate, you know, my brain hasn't melted too much from treading in these waters. And I mean, it is a challenge, particularly when you're on the boards, just because the boards are,
they're just corrosive.
There is a numbing effect to some extent from watching all of that. And so I think that, yeah, sometimes when you're just interfacing with that culture in particular and the content that's on there, like that can be some of the stuff that's like, that can have a kind of like desensitizing or numbing effect.
So I don't think I'm going to break any news here because it's been going around and the documentary is out. But on the final episode of Q Into the Storm, you have a moment where you get Ron Watkins, who's administrator of 8can or 8kun, excuse me, basically kind of in a roundabout way mentioning that he had been posting his Q. And that was like a huge breakthrough. I think this was something that like a lot of researchers and reporters kind of suspected was probably the case, but nobody ever really was able to prove it. And the Watkins fellas certainly are not huge fans of talking to reporters in general. So it's not like Ron Watkins had open media availability to, you know, be asked questions like that. When Ron Watkins said that to you, did it surprise you? I mean, you had been on this hunt for years, and I imagine you may have had the same suspicions or theories that someone like myself may have had. I guess, was it surprising, or was it kind of just a vindication? I'm curious what your experience was in that moment, because on film, he says this line about, like, well, what I had been doing for years, but never as Q, and you just sort of like crack out laughing. So can you take us inside your head during that moment?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what he said, his admission in that moment, and what he said as a contradiction to things he'd said in the past was incredibly shocking. After I was kind of done letting out the steam of just like, 3 years of cat and mouse, I turned to my cameraman and just like mouthed, he just admitted he's Q. I mean, as close as I think I would ever come to that. And, and he had been really my prime suspect since the very first time I left the Philippines. When I had gone to the Philippines to meet with him and Jim and Fred back in 2018, I didn't think at the time when I went there that they were necessarily behind Q, just that they had the technical data. And so if anybody knew who Q was, it was likely them. And when I left the Philippines, I was like, well, man, these guys are really suspicious. And I didn't know exactly, what Fred's relationship was, Jim and Ron at that point. I wasn't sure if Jim was the one who was sort of leading the charge or if it was Ron. I just knew that something more was kind of going on there. And at that time, people didn't know who they were. They were not really suspects on anyone's list. They weren't, it was hard to even find a picture of Ron. Jim, you could find a little bit more. There was some stuff of him available online. And Fred, I think, was the most public facing of the three. It wasn't really until after Christchurch that HN became, I don't want to say a household name, but certainly known around the world.
Right.
And after that, I think people started looking more into those personalities, and then you see it in the film. Fred starts talking to more reporters. Of course, he's talking to me behind the scenes, and you can sort of, just through my line of questioning, you're going to be able to glean certain facts and information, regardless of how careful I'm being in those situations. And of course, I'd spent much time with Fred when we were leaving the Philippines. And I think that people really started, I mean, Fred became the primary voice of, he was really fixated on Jim, if you recall. I mean, this was about 9-10 months ago in August of 2020. That Fred, Fred came out and was really focused on that. And of course, he was also interested in getting back at Jim for the lawsuit that forced him to flee the Philippines. I think it was also tricky for people because they're looking at what's happening there and they're wondering, well, is this guy a reliable narrator? How much of what he's saying is based on his own personal vendetta? But then there was a lot of good technical evidence to back it up as well. So I think it was around that time that people really started to move more in the direction of the Watkinses being a linchpin in the operation. But we had been working on building a case, moving in that direction for some time. He did a pretty successful job for a minute of derailing my investigation into them with the Bannon technical data that he presented to me. It was compelling initially, and I did chase that lead, but I kept both Ron and Bannon like in mind. I didn't suddenly think like, oh, it's just Steve Bannon. I was like, okay, well, let's add him as a high level suspect and see if we can get to the bottom of whether or not that's viable.
Well, speaking of this,
to answer your question, when he finally did, after all of this time, come out and say, yeah, it 3 years of military, you know, it was like 3 years of training normies how to do military work. He said 10 years of leading digs on chance. I mean, he had never mentioned to me. In fact, he'd gone out of his way on more than one occasion to say that he was not a heavy user of chance, didn't really use the boards. And here he was saying something that was a polar opposite, and not just a polar opposite. I mean, you know, kind of like king of digging, which is exactly what you would need to be Q. You don't need to be close to Trump. You just need to know what the add-ons and users of the Chan already think and how to kind of reflect that back to them.
Well, I've got one more question about the content of the documentary, and then I promise I'm not here to just quiz you and try to produce a Spark Notes version. People should definitely go watch this thing. But there was a mention, I forget which.
No, it's okay. Spark Notes, it'll be really helpful. When everybody has to watch this for class and they don't have 6 hours, you know, they can tune in. This will save some time.
All right. Well, I forget which episode this was, but there was a mention of Ron Watkins being connected with a assistant or somebody associated with Roger Stone to use some weird kind of fucked up Twitter tool to boost his visibility or to boost his reach. In the doc, you kind of mentioned it. Showed, you know, some tape and then, you know, kind of went on to the next thing. Can you explain what was going on there a little bit more? Because it seemed almost like a bullet point in the doc, but it seems like something that if fleshed out a little bit more would be really interesting to try to understand.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of these moments in the doc where I would have loved to expanded that I would have loved to have expanded on more. And this is one of them. Of course, the ex-military networks that were hijacking Q narrative and sort of seeding intel with Q-tubers and like giving them challenge coins and shit. I mean, that stuff is crazy in its own right. But this magical Twitter tool, of which there are many, don't get me wrong, Power 10 isn't the only one that's out there. This is an example of a one of these amplification methods that would allow people to game the algos and massively boost their whatever content they wanted. And so it was in late December 2019 that Ron messaged me. He's like, hey, I want you on this call. I'm going to be talking to Bill Binney and Jason Sullivan. You know, one of the things that I found while filming, especially as things progress, is that, the closer that every time Ron got closer to the actual seat of power, he did really want to document it. I mean, he would always message me, you know, if there was like some big retweeter, you know, General Flynn retweeted him, Trump retweeted him, and I think this is an example of, you could really start to see at this moment in late 2019, the Q narrative starting to bleed into mainstream politics in such a way that real power players were gravitating towards it. And so right. Those power players wanted to get on the phone with Ron because, and if you don't know who Bill Binney is, I mean, he's a famous, I mean, I don't know if you do, but for those in the audience who might not know who Bill Binney is, he was maybe the biggest NSA whistleblower prior to Edward Snowden. So for him to be on this call with Jason Sullivan, who is Roger Stone's sort of head of social media or social media expert, wanting to get in touch with Ron, not because they thought Ron was Q, but because they thought this other guy on Twitter was Q and that Ron could put them in touch with him. So Jason Sullivan was specifically on this call. The call went on for hours, but he was on this call because he thought this other account on Twitter, this is not a... He just thought this other account on Twitter, for a number of reasons, was actually Q, and he wanted to give this Twitter amplification tool to Q. That's what he was aiming for. And what you'll find is, and I didn't know what the name of the tool was at the time. I wasn't sure if he was full of shit. I had no idea. I was just kind of listening, going, "Well, this is, Q narrative is these guys are trying to make it starting to try to make it come real." Is what it seemed like. you know, and then a couple months go by, and then this article comes out in Business Insider, I believe, and it says the name of Jason, the name is Jason Sullivan, and it says the name of his tool is Power 10. Twitter caught it and, you know, been blocked. And you know, I thought, okay, well, that's probably the end of that. You know, many months later, come August, I think, you see Binny has reemerged on Twitter, and now Jason Sullivan was kind of working with him in the background, seemingly amplifying him. And then, you know, a few months later, which you see in the documentary, Ron tells me on camera that Jason Sullivan re-engineered the tool and gave it to him, and that he was using it exclusively. Now, that's what he said. I don't know if he was using it exclusively. There are data researchers right now trying to analyze, you know, exactly what the mechanics of this tool were, and, you know, if he was in fact using it. You know, Jason Sullivan hasn't like messaged me and said no, that's right. Not happening. You know, and you can see, I mean, Ron's Twitter account explodes in growth in November. I mean, he steps out, mind you, he stops being the admin of 8kun on the day of the election, and that same day, he begins, you know, this sort of new campaign on Twitter. And within a week or so, he is quickly becoming sort of Trump's last hope when it comes to the election. He becomes this sort of voting machine expert guy. And Ron goes, within a matter of months, from about 140,000 followers to over 500,000. You know, using theoretically using this tool. But I think that what is the most interesting to me about that is that Jason Sullivan wanted to put the tool in Q's hands, and he got it into Ron's hands.
Yeah, that's
so
super.
It seems like he found his target.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that could be a whole documentary in itself, but that's how these things go, man. I mean, you were filming for 3 fucking years, dude. So it's some stuff just does. You just don't get the chance to expand on it all the way.
The whole sequence isn't even in there, right? You know, like and that's actually bums me out a bit, because so we've seen so much movement recently. You know, so much of Q is kind of being absorbed into these new age communities, mm-hmm. not just in America but around the world, and. You know, that sequence captured that. It kind of showed how the sort of overlap of language and the techniques and the ways in which, Q was sort of working its way into one of these new age groups. And I think one of the other things that you see is you've got these ex-military networks that are working behind the scenes. I know this because they talked to me and it's recorded and you can listen to the film, but you know, they're reaching out to QTubers. They're reaching out to the leaders of groups like the one that I was in with cameras for that period of time. And they're feeding them a narrative and they're pushing their agendas through these outlets. I mean, this concept isn't new. They've been doing it for decades. And of course he's been, kind of a proxy for the same kind of ops for a number of years. But what is new is the medium, using YouTubers, and I don't know how long, the kind of new age group connection had been going on for, seems kind of new to me, but, certainly the YouTuber thing is new.
So zooming back out a bit, you started working on this documentary, I guess, what was it, like 3 years, right?
Yeah, it was about, yeah. It was about 3 years ago.
About 3 years ago. That was really as Q was starting to kind of sink its teeth into the world and was emerging. There were some reporters and researchers at the time that saw this. And, you know, I, at the time, felt like, oh, this feels a little different. This seems like this has legs or is going to be around a while. Unfortunately, I was correct. But you were able to get, you know, even more intimate with some of these figures promoting this stuff than like even I was able to get access to in my day to day. Of course, I worked for a progressive nonprofit, so of course I was part of the the Soros cabal or whatever, but you know, I'm curious right, what right. your perspective was being so close to the nexus of this stuff.
Well, I was in a bit of a different situation, right? Because I had come at this producing independently, you know, I think a lot of those who were Q believers were more, and Q-tubers were more open to talking to me. And certainly once I filmed with Code Monkey, I mean, you know, he's a figure of lore in the like Q community. And so that also opened up a lot of doors.
So as somebody who's been working on it so long and has been working on it like very, very deep in the weeds, like often literally alongside, you know, not alongside in the sense of like helping them promote Q, but alongside like physically in the same rooms and conference centers as these people, like watching Q grow. I'm curious what your perspective was on like watching QAnon go from this weird sort of conspiracy trend on the internet into something that was coming out of the words of the president and national reporters in the press room. Like, do you have any like thoughts or reflections on that evolution? Is that something you ever expected to happen when you started?
You probably had something similar. I mean, there were just these moments, you know what it felt like, Jared? It felt like my jaw just kept dropping. And I didn't think it could drop any lower, and then it just kept dropping until it hit the floor and then just went through the floor. You know, by the time I saw Ron Code Monkey on OAN, now the advisor to the President of the United States. I think that was right, you know, as his sort of last hope. That was there was no more room for my jaw to drop at that point, you would have thought. And then January 6th happened. You know, but at the same time, even though there was this sort of series of you know, sort of being shocked by certain moments, I think that I did expect that it was going to keep growing, and some of those things that happened along the way, you could kind of like by the time you got there, you know, it didn't seem as quite as impossible. But had you said 3 years earlier that those things would have happened, it would have seemed just patently absurd. And I remember right when I got started, I talked to many people, and I, you know, they kept, they would say like, oh, well, Q's on its way out. Q's dying. I'm sure you heard that from a number of folks as well.
Right.
You know, it's not, I think you and Will Sommer like both had a sense that no, it's anytime someone's kind of predicted that it's gonna taper off, it only grows. So it's kind of like in science saying, you know, something's impossible. It's usually a mistake to say that. I mean, the series really does. That's one of the things I tried to prioritize in the series, was charting that growth and capturing those moments that really blew me away, and kind of charting the nature of meme magic. You know, this thing that started as a joke on the internet, you know, kind of a, like, you know, a group of people who were role playing as Q, that enough people started, you know, they start pretending and they start believing the thing they pretend, and then eventually they become the thing that they were pretending. And charting this sort of will to meme Q into existence, which is what we eventually saw. So really, it really speaks to the nature of belief and just how powerful it really is. And that we have to really be careful what we choose to pretend to be, because, you know, we can just, if you do that, you can easily just become that thing.
Right. There's the old cliche, and I think I'll end with this. It goes something, and I'm going to butcher it, I already know, but it's something like, be careful what you read, because that is how you'll think. be careful how you think, because that's how you'll act. And I think that is, like, meme magic is kind of a modern derivative of that old cliche. And Q's a great example of that. So
yeah, Fred Brennan, that's great. Yeah, Fred Brennan said to me the very first time we talked, I don't think this is in the series, but he said, Q is a meme, and all memes must die. At the end of shooting, you know, he said, well, I thought Q was a meme, but maybe Q is a religion. We're going to be stuck with it for a really long time.
Yeah, in some form or another, that's for
sure. In some form or another, yeah. I think, you know, I'm sure you've been asked this question a lot of times. You know, where is Q going from here? And you know, I do think that we're seeing a kind of splinter right now, and it's changing, and we might see different flavors of the same thing. But what I hope that the series does anyway is that it, you know, it really reveals the nature of the magic trick. And, you know, I kind of think of Q like a magic trick, but a lot of people believe. But if you reveal the nature of a magic trick, it can't work again. And that's what I think, where so much of the power of kind of showing the mechanics of something rests, and showing the forces behind that something as well. Because it demystifies it, and it takes its power away.
So I've been talking with Colin Hoback. He's the director of the new HBO series, docuseries, I should say, Q Into the Storm. Colin, every guest on this podcast gets the same final question. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
My favorite thing on the internet right now. Oh, wow. I mean, I guess in the last couple of months, I've enjoyed watching everything that happened around GameStop. That was my favorite thing on the internet as of late.
The game stocks. That's a great answer. Well, Colin, where can people keep up with you and all the work you're doing from the past, current, and future?
Well, the only social media I really use is Twitter, and I've been more active on there lately, just because you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of questions, and doing my best to answer them all and to, you know, fill in some blanks and keep the conversation going. It's just at Colin Hoback.